Today's sermon passage is found in the book of James in chapter 2, James chapter 2, verses 18 through 26. If you would please turn there to follow along as I read. James 2, starting in verse 18. But someone will say, "You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead."
Thanks, Rachel. Well, we are continuing our sermon series in the book of James this morning. And as we do, I want you to think for just a minute about things that go together. So I'm not talking about Lego sets or IKEA furniture. I'm talking about two things that are so closely related in our minds that they're pretty much inseparable. So much so that if I just say one of those things, you know what the other one is. So let's try this out. Let's play a little game here. Things like salt and
pepper.
Good job. Yes, yell it out. This is the audience participation part of our sermon this morning. So how about peanut butter and
jelly?
Good. And technically the right answer there is strawberry jelly, just so you know. Ketchup and mustard. Macaroni and And it's not just food either, right? How about hide and?
Feet.
Yep. Thunder and?
Rain.
Yeah. Needle and?
Red.
Pencil and?
Fear.
Good. Yeah. And we could keep on going, right? There's all kinds of things like that. Kansas City and barbecue. Cross Fellowship Church and staying late to talk. Like, we take that fellowship part of our name really seriously. If you haven't gotten to know us yet, you'll find that out quickly. The point of all this, though, is that what we saw last week and what we're going to press into even more this week is that James would add another pair of things to that list that we're just talking about. And that pair of things is faith and works. And so James' whole point in this section of the book is that those two things, faith and works, are so closely related that they should be inseparable in our minds as well. So the problem is, that one makes us a little bit uncomfortable, right? For a couple of reasons. One, first and foremost, because it sounds like James is contradicting one of the central beliefs that we hold to. Like, it's one of the five solas of the Reformation, right? Sola fide, faith alone. Like, we can't do anything to earn our salvation by our works. Our only hope is that we are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Jesus Christ alone, to the glory of God alone. Like that's a major point of emphasis for us in our theology. It's a major point of emphasis for Paul, especially in the New Testament. And so we went through Romans not that long ago. Paul says in Romans 3:28, we hold that one is justified by faith apart from works of the law. Like, that's the lens that we tend to view faith and works through. And so we tend to focus on how faith and works are completely separate and don't go together at all. And that if you try to put them together, you lose the gospel. And so when we come to this part of James 2:24 in particular, that Rachel just read a second ago, which says, you see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. Like, it sounds like the exact opposite of Paul and the exact opposite of the gospel, and makes us really uncomfortable. So some would deal with that tension between Romans 3:28 and James 2:24 by saying that Paul and James actually disagree, which means that there are contradictions in the Bible. But we don't believe that's the answer. We believe that if we ever find something that sounds like a contradiction in the Bible, the problem is with us, not with the Bible. Others would deal with that tension by saying, well, then James must not mean what it sounds like he means here. And then they either redefine some of the words that James uses or try to soften somehow what James is saying to try to help James agree with Paul. The problem is that James defines the words that he uses here for us, and he doesn't soften or nuance what he's saying at all. And so the answer here is that Paul and James are actually responding to two different issues. So Paul is responding to people who are trying to earn salvation, to earn a righteous verdict before God by keeping the law, by following all the external religious rituals and practices laid out in the Old Testament law. And Paul's point is that's not possible. Like, we're already guilty, both in Adam through his disobedience in the garden, and also because then we have failed to fully keep the law personally. And so no amount of good works now can pay the penalty that we owe. So if we try to earn a righteous verdict through our works, we will end up facing the wrath of God that our sin deserves. Now, but the good news that Paul talks about is that God sent his son, Jesus, to keep the law perfectly in our place. And to die then, the death that we deserve for our sin as our substitute. And it's only by faith in Jesus, by trusting in his work alone in our place, that we can be declared righteous before God. Like, that's what Paul means by faith alone apart from works of the law. But James is responding to a different issue. He's responding to people who think that all you need to receive a righteous verdict before God is saying that you believe the right things. That as long as you believe the right things, it doesn't matter if your life is completely inconsistent with what you say you believe. Like, that's what James is addressing when he talks about faith and works being inseparable. And we'll get to this more in just a minute. And so the point is, if we let James define his terms and listen to what he's actually saying here, we'll see that he's not contradicting Paul at all. That James would actually totally agree with what Paul says in Romans 3:28. And Paul would completely agree with what James is saying in James 2:24. They're just complementing each other and looking at the same thing from two different angles. And so even though James' emphasis on faith and works being inseparable can make us a little bit uncomfortable at first, it shouldn't. And that's one of my goals and one of my prayers for us this morning, is that we would better understand what James is saying here and eagerly affirm what James is saying here instead of being uncomfortable that it might contradict Paul or even the gospel. But that's only one way this idea of faith and works being inseparable can make us uncomfortable, because we hear what James is saying here and we wonder if he's wrong. The other way is that this idea of faith and works being inseparable can make us uncomfortable because we hear what James is saying and we wonder if he's right. And I know a number of us are feeling this over the past few weeks as we've been working our way through this book. Like, we hear what James is saying here and we see all the ways that we fall short of doing it. We see our tendency to be hearers of the word but not doers to the extent that we know we should be. We see ways we've acted out of partiality. We see the opportunities that we've had to care for or to help widows or orphans or the poor. And we could have done so much more than we did. And it makes us question, like, if faith and works are inseparable, like, do we have the faith we think we have? And so if that's you, let me just say that's exactly the question that James intends for his readers to be asking at this point. Going all the way back to chapter 1, verse 22, like he wants to make sure that none of his readers are deceiving themselves into thinking that they're Christians when they're really not. That's exactly what James is addressing here in these verses. How do you know if you're actually a believer? Like, how do you know if your faith is true, saving faith? Well, at the same time, if that's you, know that James' goal in all this is not to stir up doubt or guilt in you. Like his goal, and this is my other goal and my other prayer for us this morning, is that we would examine our hearts and lives in light of what James is saying here, and that those who don't have true saving faith would come to true saving faith for the first time. And that those who do have true saving faith would be stirred up to live more and more like who we are. Not feel this as a burden, but that we would do that with joy. Because James' whole point in James 2, 18 to 26 is that saving faith works. That's what he's going to argue for and prove here in these verses. And we'll see what he means by that as we go. So the way we're going to go about that this morning, you can see this on your handout. Our passage this morning starts with the word but, which means it's contrasting with what came before. So we need to quickly look back at James' previous point from last week to make sure we're tracking with his argument so far. And then we're going to see a potential objection that James brings up in the first part of verse 18, which we'll see reflects the same tension and uncomfortability that we feel at this point with everything that James has said so far, like we just talked about. And then we'll see how James responds to this potential objection from the second half of verse 18 through verse 25. And this is going to be huge because it's the exact response that we need to hear as well in light of our own uncomfortability with what James has been saying. And so in verses 18 to 25, he's going to give us three proofs that faith and works are inseparable. And then we'll see the conclusion he draws in light of these three proofs in verse 26. And so that's where we're headed this morning. And so first, let's remind ourselves of James' previous point so that we can get into verses 18 to 26 in our passage for today. And so as tempted as I am to read back through James 2, 14 to 17, we're not going to for time's sake. And so if you missed last week, I'd encourage you, go back and listen to John's sermon on this passage later. But the main point that we really need to pick back up on is the final thing that James says in verse 17 that basically sums up his point in verses 14 to 17. And so here's what he says. You can see this in verse 17 there in James chapter 2. He says, So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Or if you simplify that down a little bit, James' previous point is, and you can see this on your handout, that faith apart from works is dead. But this is where we have to be really careful not to read Paul's definitions of faith and works into what James is saying here. Otherwise, we'll end up completely misunderstanding James' point. And so let's take just a minute and look at how James is using three key words here in verse 17. So first, when James says faith, he's talking about saying that you believe the right things. We see that in verse 14. Someone says he has faith. So this is someone that claims to believe, that they have the right head knowledge. And so we'll talk about this more when we get into verse 19, but at one level, this is a good thing. You need to believe certain truths and hold to certain truths to be a Christian. But the point for now is that when James is talking about faith here, what he's talking about is just that, just saying that you believe the right things. When he talks about works, then, he's talking about living in a way that's consistent with what you say you believe. And so this is huge. He's not talking about trying to earn your salvation by your works. He's talking about living in a way that's consistent with what you say you believe. So living like a follower of Jesus. And he's already been giving us examples of what kinds of things he has in mind over the last few sections. So going back to chapter 1, verse 26, bridling your tongue, visiting orphans and widows in their affliction, keeping yourself unstained from the world. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 13, not showing partiality or favoritism. Chapter 2, 14 to 17, last week, meeting the physical needs of the poor. And he's going to give us more examples as we get into chapters 3 and 4. And so we've seen, though, along the way with each one of these, is that these things all make sense for us to do as Christians because they all reflect the gospel in different ways. We don't do them to earn our salvation. We do them because that's who we are as those who have received salvation. Like, we were weak and vulnerable. But God cared for us and visited us in our affliction. We were lowly, but God welcomed us in and gave us a place of honor. We were poor and needy, but God met our ultimate need. And so now we live in a way that reflects those gospel realities. So James is saying that if you believe the right things, but you don't live in a way that's consistent with what you say you believe, that kind of faith without that kind of works is dead. Which by dead, he means not saving faith. Like that's what he says in verse 14 again. Can that kind of faith save him? That kind of faith that we just talked about. That kind of faith that claims to believe the right things but doesn't live consistently with them. And the answer is no, it can't. And so it's exactly the same point going back to chapter 1, verse 22. Faith apart from works is the same as being a hearer of the word but not a doer. And hearers only are deceiving themselves. Like that is James' main concern in this entire section, going all the way back to chapter 1, verse 22, that his readers don't deceive themselves into thinking they're Christians when they're not. And so that's what we have to keep in mind to be able to track with what James is saying in our passage this morning. He's actually not making a case between faith and works. He's making a case between two kinds of faith. And so you can see this on your handout. James is not arguing faith versus works. He's arguing true saving faith versus false not saving faith. And his point is that saying you believe the right things but not living consistently with what you say you believe is false not saving faith. That's what he means by faith apart from works is dead. So that's James' previous point, which sets up a potential objection here. And so we see this potential objection in the first part of verse 18. And it's, again, it's an objection that we resonate with. It's the tension that we feel at this point as well in light of James' previous point. And so you can see this on your handout. And I did edit this point a little bit after I sent it in for the worship guide, so you can correct it on your handout there if you want. Here's how I would edit this a little bit. The potential objection is that faith and works aren't both necessary for saving faith. So faith and works aren't both necessary for saving faith. And so it's probably not immediately obvious that that's what the objection here is in verse 18, but let's look at it together and unpack what's going on here. So look at verse 18. James says, "But someone will say, you have faith and I have works." So James understands that someone, probably a lot of someones, will potentially push back on what he just said. And so he speaks on their behalf and puts their concern into words so that he can respond to it. And the way that he words this hypothetical pushback is, "You have faith and I have works." And so it's a little surprising that this someone here seems to attribute faith to James and works to themselves. We kind of expect it to be the other way around. But the main point is that this hypothetical objector here is picking up on what James is saying. He's picking up on James' point that faith and works are both necessary for saving faith. And they're arguing that that's not true. It seems that what this someone here is arguing is that some Christians have faith and some Christians have works, and that either one is equally valuable. So their objection is that the faith and works that James has been talking about are not both and, they're either or. Faith and works aren't both necessary for saving faith. And James' response is going to be that they're absolutely both necessary. That faith and works are inseparable for saving faith. But the way that he responds also is going to seem to specifically target the side that would say that the works piece is the unnecessary piece. All the way through his responses here, he's going to treat the faith piece, the believing the right things piece, as a given. Like, of course that's necessary. What he's going to argue that you can't lose is the works piece, the living consistently with what you believe. So it seems like James is understanding this hypothetical objector to be saying something to the effect of, "Come on, James, some of us are head people and some of us are hands people. Like, some of us are creeds people and some of us are deeds people. It's great for some Christians to take care of the physical needs of the poor and care for widows and orphans. I do that myself. But surely you're not saying that both are necessary for saving faith. What we're going to see is that that's exactly what he's saying, which, again, makes us pretty uncomfortable at first. And so we may word this objection slightly differently than the someone here in verse 18, but we resonate with this objection in a lot of ways, or we're at least asking similar questions at this point. And so how does James respond to this? How does James respond to this potential objection? You can see that next on your handout. James is going to respond to this objection by giving us three proofs that faith and works are inseparable. Three proofs that faith and works are inseparable. So James makes the initial statement that faith apart from works is dead. This hypothetical someone pushes back, surely you don't mean that faith and works are both necessary for saving faith. And James responds with these three proofs to convince us that that's exactly what he means and that what he's saying is true. And so let's look at these three proofs together. We see the first proof in the second half of verse 18, and it's this. It's what you do shows what you actually believe. What you do shows what you actually believe. So look with me at verse 18. James' first response to the potential objection here is, show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. So basically, James' first response here is to challenge this objector to a little contest. Like, the objector's argument is that faith and works are an either or. You don't need them both. So James says, okay, let's show each other our faith then. But since you don't need works, you're not allowed to show me your faith by doing any works or pointing to any works that you've done. But I'll show you my faith by my works. And James' point is, like, he's going to win that contest. There's no way the objector can show James his faith apart from doing any works. And so just think for a minute about how true that is. Like, even if you want to argue that faith and works are separate things and that faith alone is necessary for salvation, the reality is that what you believe always overflows into what you do, and what you do shows what you actually believe. Like, you ate breakfast this morning because you believed it would give you energy to get through the day until lunch. Or you didn't eat breakfast because you believed you didn't need it to get through till lunch. You drove your car here this morning because you believed it would get you here. You sat down in these pews this morning because you believed they would hold you up. But even more than that, like, you came here this morning because at some level you believed that being at church was a good thing to do. Hopefully it's because you are trusting in Jesus, which makes you part of the people of God. And you believe that gathering with his people to worship him and hear his word preached is what you do because of who you are. You sang the songs this morning because you believe that through them we worship the Lord together, encourage one another. You're listening to this sermon because you believe that God will work through his word to shape you and sanctify you. Hopefully that's true. But whatever the reason, even if you're not a Christian here this morning, you're here this morning because of what you believe, whether you realize it or not. So here's the thing, like, you may not consciously always be thinking about what you believe as you do what you do, but we always do what we do because of what we believe, and what we do always shows what we believe. So if you want to get an idea of what someone actually believes, look at what they do. Look at how they use their time. Look at how they spend their money. Look at how they talk. Look at how they treat others. Look at how they read their Bible and pray. Look at how they don't read their Bible and pray. What we do shows what we believe. And there's a great illustration of this in Mark chapter 2 with the paralytic and his four friends that brought him to Jesus to be healed. You remember this story? Like, when the four friends bring this man to Jesus, that the house where Jesus is teaching is so full of people, they can't get to him. So what do they do? They take their friend up on the roof, right? And they open up a hole in the roof above Jesus, and they lower this man down through the roof right in front of Jesus. And do you remember what Mark says about this? Mark chapter 2, verse 5 says, "And when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, 'Son, your sins are forgiven.'" So catch that. What did Jesus see? Like, he saw the four men carry their friend up on the roof and make a hole in the roof and lower their friend down in front of him. Like, he saw their works. But Mark says that he saw their faith. Because what you do shows what you believe. They believed that Jesus could heal their friend, so they went to whatever lengths necessary to get him in front of Jesus. And there's many more examples like this. I mean, just think about like Hebrews 11. It's commonly called the Hall of Faith, right? It's an entire chapter of biblical person after biblical person celebrating their faith. But how does it celebrate their faith? By remembering what they did. What they did showed what they believed. Like, that's what James is talking about when he says that faith and works are inseparable here. That what you do shows what you actually believe, and therefore faith and works are inseparable. Like, that's the first proof. See the second one then in verse 19, and it's this: good theology alone won't save you. See that in verse 19, look at that. It says, "But you believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder." Man, like, this one hits close to home. Look at what James is saying here. And so again, the "you" here is the subjector from the beginning of verse 18. And James is responding to them again. And he's willing here to give them credit for having good theology. Like, that's what we see at the beginning of verse 19 there. He says, "You believe that God is one." And so that little phrase, "God is one," there hopefully sounds familiar. It's the beginning of the Shema, of Israel's confession of faith that they would have repeated often. We see it in Deuteronomy 6:4 and following. Starts in Deuteronomy 6:4 with, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And it goes on from there to talking about loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and might, meditating on the law and teaching it to your children, obeying the Lord and keeping his commandments, not following after your own desires. But James takes just the very first few words of that statement of faith and focuses in on that one important foundational truth right at the beginning, that God is one. And he says, "You believe that? Great. Awesome. You do well. Like, good for you." And at one level, he sincerely means that. Like, yes, believe that. Like, you must believe that. If you don't believe that, there's no point in going any further in this conversation about both faith and works being necessary for saving faith, because you don't have the faith part. But at another level, he's setting them up. Because look at what he says next. He says, "You believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe." Like, man, do you see what he's saying here? You believe this essential, foundational truth about God? Great. Like, believe that. Like, you must believe that. But so do the demons. Like, the demons have really good theology. Like, they know that God is one. And they know that the one God is Yahweh. And James is going to go even one step further than that. Not just that they know this, but look at the end of the verse. Like, the word "shudder" there means violent shaking from extreme fear. Like the demons not only know this is true, they tremble in fear of the Lord because of what they know about him. And so the point is that what demons believe about God produces an emotional reaction in them, just not actions in keeping with what they know to be true. They continue to work against God, the very God that they know about and fear. And so, like, do you see the implications of this? Like, there's a way to check all the right boxes theologically and be no better off than the demons. Like, you can read all the best theology books, know all the right theological answers, and genuinely believe them. Like, you can even have an emotional response to theological truth. And all that is good, even necessary for saving faith. But there's also a way that you can have all that and be no better off than the demons, which is terrifying. Like, the distinction here, though, is that the demons believe that God is one, and they tremble, but it doesn't change what they do. So the point is, if what you believe has no impact on how you live, it's not saving faith. Like, this is what John was talking about last week in his introduction, if you remember. Like, as pastors, we've heard so many testimonies over the years of people who would say they were converted at a young age because they made a profession of faith when they were little, and then nothing changed in their life until 10 or 20 years later when some other thing happened and they rededicated their lives to Jesus, or however, whatever words they want to use for it. James is saying, that's not possible. If all you have is good theology, like if all you have is a profession of faith, but your theology or your profession of faith doesn't affect anything about how you live, it's not saving faith. And Jesus connects all these dots as well in Mark 12, verses 29 to 31. When he's asked what the greatest commandment is, do you remember how he answered? Jesus answered Mark 12, 29. The most important is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." Like, do you see it here? Jesus connects what we believe, starting with that same basic truth that James does here, that God is one, with what we do. Love God and love neighbor. Like, believing the truth about God must flow into love for God and love for neighbor, or it's less than saving faith. And that's what James means here when he says that faith and works are inseparable. That good theology alone won't save you, can't save you, if that's all you have. And that's the second proof. And then the third and final proof that we see here is in verses 20 to 25. And it's this, that the biblical principle is that saving faith works. So there's a whole lot here, but let's start, look at verse 20 to dive into this, and then we'll jump around a little bit and try to follow what James is saying here. Look at verse 20. It says, "Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless?" And so James has one more response to this objector. This is like the final nail in the coffin here, and he lets us know how he really feels about this objector now as well. Calls them foolish or empty. And he's going to show them or prove to them, is what that's talking about there, that faith and works are inseparable through this one more thing. And I love how he says this here, though. The word useless there, it's actually the same root as the word for works with a negative prefix. And so it basically just means without work or workless. So what James is now going to show them is that faith without works it doesn't work. Faith without works doesn't work. That's what he says here. And he's going to prove it by pointing out these two Old Testament heroes of faith, Abraham in verse 21 and Rahab in verse 25. And he's not just randomly choosing these two examples. Like, he's giving us these two because they're two polar opposite ends of the spectrum. He calls Abraham here, Abraham our father. And just think about what we know about Abraham. He was a Jew. He was a man. And as the father of the Israelites, he's a symbol of righteousness. On the other hand, we've got Rahab, and he calls Rahab the prostitute. And what do we know about Rahab, if you're familiar with her story? She's a Gentile, she's a woman, and as a prostitute, she's a symbol of unrighteousness. And so you have the patriarch and the prostitute. And the point is that you couldn't get any more polar opposite than these two. They're opposites in about every way you can possibly imagine. But what James is going to show is that the same thing was true for both of them. And the point is, if that was true for these two people on these extreme ends of the spectrum, then it's true for everyone else in between, like including us. And so what's the thing that was true for both of them? And so if you look at verse 21 and verse 25, you'll notice they're worded almost identically to highlight the parallel here. And so look first at verse 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? And then skip down to verse 25. And in the same way, was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? So both verses here are worded as questions. And the question basically boils down to, was not this person justified by works when they did this specific work? And the shocking thing is, both of these questions are worded in a way that expects the reader, that expects that we will answer, yes, of course they were, which is not what we think the answer to this ought to be. But that's what James is saying was true for both of them, that they were both justified by works when they did a specific thing. Which again, we hear James say that Abraham and Rahab were justified by works with Romans 3:28 in the back of our minds, and we start getting really uncomfortable and nervous about now. But James is going to explain exactly what he means here if we'll just let him do it. And so let's follow along with the verses in between these two verses. And what we're going to see is in verses 22 through 24, you get these two you see sentences, these two you see statements. And so at the beginning of this, he says, I'm going to show you something from these two people. And now he's going to give us the two things he wants us to see here in between. And so the first you see sentence is in verse 22 and 23. And it's going to break down Abraham's story in particular to explain what he means by Abraham being justified by works. And then the second you see sentence in verse 24 summarizes and universalizes the principle that he draws from Abraham. And this is all structured in a way then that the main points there in the middle are true of both people on the outside, so Rahab as well. And so follow James' argument here, starting in verse 21. And so he's making the case again that Abraham was justified by works when he offered up Isaac on the altar. And so hopefully you remember that story. We went through Genesis just before James. So if you've been around for a little while, you've probably heard us go through this. But Genesis 22 was a little while ago. So remember, God chose Abraham to be the father of his special people. And he promised him offspring as uncountable as the stars. But up until Abraham was 100 years old, he had no children, right? But then God miraculously gave Abraham and his wife Sarah, who's 90 years old, a son named Isaac. And God told them that this was the son that he was going to fulfill his promises through. And so in many ways, nothing was more precious and valuable to Abraham and Sarah than Isaac. And then a few chapters, a few years later, God told Abraham to take his son, his only son, Isaac, whom he loved, and sacrifice him on a mountain that God would show him. And so you can just imagine the confusion and the conflict in Abraham's heart and mind. Like, not only would this be just awful, terrible to think about sacrificing your child at all, like, this is the son that God told him would be the line of promise. Like, it made no sense for God to tell him to do what he's telling him to do, to sacrifice this child that all the promises hang on. But what did he do, if you remember the story? He got up, saddled the donkey, gathered wood, took Isaac, and headed off for the mountain. And on the way, if you remember, Isaac asked Abraham, hey, we're missing something here. Where's the lamb for the sacrifice? And you remember what Abraham's answer was? God will provide for himself the lamb for the sacrifice. So they get to the mountain. Abraham builds the altar. He binds Isaac, lays him on the wood, raises the knife to sacrifice him like God had said. And at the last moment, God calls out to Abraham to stop and spares Isaac's life. And God did provide a ram that was caught in a thicket as a sacrifice instead of Isaac. And here's the important part. After Abraham sacrificed this ram in place of Isaac, God told him, because you did this, I will surely keep all the promises that I made you. The thing is, though, if you remember, God had already told Abraham he would do that earlier in Genesis 15, verse 6. after Abraham believed what God told him about his offspring being as uncountable as the stars, which is the point that Paul makes in Romans when he says that Abraham was justified by faith before he did any works. But look at what James says here. He says that Abraham was justified by works when he offered Isaac in Genesis 22. But then he explains what he means by that in these next two verses. And so look at verse 22 and verse 23. It says, "You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God." And so verse 22 unpacks what James means by works, and verse 23 unpacks what he means by justified. And so let's look at verse 23 first, because we're trying to, what does James mean when he says that Abraham was justified by works? And so verse 23, we'll see what he means by justified. When James is talking about Abraham being justified, he's talking about two things he says here: righteousness and friendship. Righteousness, meaning he's no longer guilty, and friendship, meaning he's no longer an enemy. So, as much as we may want to say that James must be talking about justification in a different way than Paul, I don't think James gives us that option. He's talking about righteousness and friendship in the same way that Paul is thinking of justification. So the key is understanding what James means that he was justified by works. And so look back at verse 22. He's talking about two things there as well. So the first thing that he means, he says, is that faith was active along with his works. And that phrase, active along with there, it's another word from the same root as works. He likes all these works, words, word plays in this section here. And so this word means worked together with. And so James is saying that Abraham's faith worked together with his works, or worked with his works. So that's the first thing that he's saying about what he means by works, is Abraham's faith working together with, or working with, his works. Second, he says that Abraham's faith was completed by his works. So James is saying that not only did Abraham's faith work with his works completed his faith. And so the picture here is of faith and works kind of as this circle, if you're tracking with him here. Faith is working through his works, and works are completing his faith in a way that this works and faith are so inseparable that you can't pull them apart. Like, that's what James means when he's using works here. This inseparable faith and works, or faith that works. Like, faith and works are so inseparable here that James has no problem using works to refer to this whole faith that works thing that he's explaining here. And so putting all that together, James is saying that in a real way, Abraham received the fulfillment of Genesis 15:6 when he offered up Isaac on the altar. That God meant what he said in Genesis 22, "Because you did this, I will surely fulfill my promises to you." That if Abraham hadn't obeyed and offered up Isaac, his faith would have been incomplete. That faith and works are inseparable. That saving faith works. That's what he's talking about with Abraham. And James doesn't break down Rahab's story quite the same way, but the point is that the same is true for her. Like, she was justified by works when, as a citizen of Jericho, a Gentile pagan outside of the people of God, she received the Israelite messengers or spies in Joshua chapter 2 and hid them and then helped them escape because she believed that their God was the true God, even though helping them could have cost her life. But because of what she did later on, the Bible says God spared her life, and she actually became part of the line that ultimately led to Jesus. She's in the genealogy of Jesus at the beginning of Matthew. And so remember here, James isn't arguing faith versus works. He's arguing true saving faith versus false not saving faith. And he's saying that Abraham and Rahab are examples of true saving faith because their faith worked, which leads to the other UC statement in verse 24 then that summarizes and universalizes this principle that James wants us to see in all this. It says, you see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. And so James, what I mean by universalizing this is that he's moving from just Abraham and Rahab to a person. Like, this is not just the reality for these two people, not just for Abraham and Rahab, but for everyone in between them on that spectrum we talked about, including us. And so hopefully this is getting to where it's not making us as uncomfortable now, because we know that James isn't saying that we earn justification by anything that we do. He's using works here as a shorthand for that inseparable faith that works as opposed to faith alone that doesn't affect how you live at all. And so he's arguing true saving faith works and false saving or false not saving faith doesn't. And that for all of us, that's true, that we are justified by this faith that works, saving faith works, and not or false not saving faith doesn't. Which is what we see then in his conclusion here in verse 26, which brings us back to where we started, and you can see this on your handout. His conclusion then is that faith apart from works is dead. Look at verse 26. It says, for as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. Like, that's how inseparable faith and works are. Like, if you take away the spirit from a body, all you have is a corpse. And if you take away works from faith, that faith is dead. It's false, not saving faith. One commentator summed it up this way. It's not just that faith is brought to life by these deeds. Without them, there was no faith at all from the very start. Such a faith hasn't died. It had never, ever been alive. It was a corpse and had at all times been a corpse. Oh, and do you see how all this, though, as much as it could like weigh on us and leave us just overwhelmed, how it actually points us to the gospel? Like, our problem wasn't just that we were sinful. It's that we were dead. Like, we couldn't work like James talks about, because dead people can't do that. And so, of course, our faith didn't have works and was dead because we were dead. Like, if our faith is dead, it's because we're dead spiritually. But God sent his son Jesus to make us alive through his work. Like, he lived the perfect life in our place that we failed to live in our rebellion against God. And then he died the death that we deserved as our substitute. And he didn't stay dead, though. He rose again 3 days later, defeating death and rising as the firstborn of the new creation. And he gives that new life then to all who are united to him by faith, who don't just have the right head knowledge about him, but who put all their trust and all their hope in Jesus' work in their place to be justified, to be declared righteous, and to be made a friend of God. Like, when we're united to Jesus by faith in that way, we're made alive. And that new life then begins to work. Like, works aren't a threat to the gospel. They're the natural outflow and overflow of it. Like, if you have true saving faith, you don't have to work up works. Like, you can't stop them. Like, the works are evidence of life. So much so that that kind of faith and that kind of works are inseparable. Like, you can't have one without the other. And so to the extent that James is able to say that, he's saying that the works are the distinguishing marks that true saving faith exists. Like, that's what he's saying, that saving faith works. And so if you're here this morning and you're not sure if you have this kind of works in your life, the response is not to grit your teeth and start doing those works. It's to examine yourself and see if you have this kind of faith. It's to look to Jesus, to trust in Jesus alone for your salvation, not anything that you can do to earn your own justification. And if you will trust Him, that true saving faith will begin to work. And if you have that true saving faith, but you're feeling overwhelmed by this and feeling your inability to do enough works, like, the point here is not for you to do enough. Like, Jesus' work is the basis of your salvation, not your works. There's maybe some good questions for you to ask here. Like, what opportunities is the Lord putting in front of you? If you really believe what you say you believe, how would you respond to the opportunities that God's putting in front of you? But James' goal is not for you to walk out of here this morning feeling this crushing burden of needing to work. We're going to walk out of here and it's like, oh man, I got to get busy. Like, that's not what we should be walking out of here with. The call this morning is like, what He's trying to do is to stir you up to eagerly and joyfully live in a way that's consistent with what you believe. Like, we should hear James' call over these last few weeks to care for widows and orphans and meet the physical needs of the poor and get excited. Like, let's go. Like, not to earn anything, but because that's who we are. Because faith and works are inseparable, like James talks about here in our passage this morning. Because saving faith works. Let's pray. Father, this is a hard passage. It makes us uncomfortable to think about some of these things, to be confronted with some of the statements that James makes, and he doesn't back down. He doesn't soften them. He doesn't nuance them. He just says it. He's okay saying it. And a lot of times we're not. And so, Lord, I pray that You would help us to press into that a little bit in each of our own hearts. Lord, where our understanding of what James is saying here is off, to where that's what makes us uncomfortable, help us to understand better what He's talking about here so that we're not afraid of talking about faith and works as being inseparable in the way that James is talking about them here. Because our tendency, if we're not careful, is to make excuses for the fact that we don't have these kinds of things. Lord, help us to see instead that that's a really dangerous warning sign if we don't see these things in our lives and not to write that off as protecting the gospel in some way. Lord, confront us as well with the other tendency here to just feel overwhelmed and ridden with guilt because we're not doing enough. Help us to see that that's not what we're supposed to take away from this either. Guard us from that. Lord, the point is not that we can't ever do enough, that we're not trying to do any of this to earn anything. It's just the natural overflow of this new life that we have through faith in Jesus. It's the same three things we've been talking about over the last few weeks, that Jesus is the basis of our salvation, faith is the means of our salvation, works are the evidence of our salvation, and all three of those are so tightly connected that we can't pull them apart. And so James is able to use this one to represent all of it. And Lord, help us to see that, to rest in that, to rest in Jesus and His work in our place. And then that new life that we receive by faith in Him, as we are justified, as we are counted righteous in Christ and called friends of God in Christ, that new life that You've given us would produce these works more and more and more. Lord, help us to hear the call here in James to examine our hearts and see if that's us or not. And if it is us, pray that it would cause us to joyfully, eagerly obey and work, not to earn anything from You, but because that's who we are. And pray that we'd walk out of here this morning rejoicing in Jesus' work in our place, the life that we have in him through faith and the works that that produces in us, because all that's just completely inseparable. And so, Lord, as we sing and as we celebrate the Lord's Supper this morning, remind us of those things, and I pray that that's what would be ringing in our ears as we walk out of here this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.